honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 96-year-old Forrest Hilton. A native of Pine Bluff, Arkansas, he has called San Jose, California home for more than 70 years now. But during World War II, his floating home away from home was the attack transport USS Haywood. In addition to his work as a boat engineer on landing craft, he also served in the Haywood's engine room. Today, he's one of the last remaining witnesses of a brutal battle that unfolded in the Gilbert Islands in November 1943, when nearly 1,700 Americans were killed and 2,100 more wounded in just 76 hours of fighting.
Well, Turamo was known to be well fortified, small island. It was only about a mile and a half long and three-quarters of a mile wide, but fortified with blockhouses and trenches. There was something that I had never heard anybody mention, was when we got the word that we was going to go there, we was down in New Zealand, Wellington, New Zealand. We had been briefed that we had a special time, we was going to land, but just before we was to land, there was supposed to be two waves of B-17 bombers with blockbusters. Now, I've never heard anybody else mentioned that. But anyway, so we got in there with our troops and got up to the line of departure and waited. And the time that those bombers was supposed to be there, there was no bombers. And we waited, I don't know, maybe 2 hours or more, and the bombers never did come. And we never did find out why they didn't come. But anyway, the tide had gone out, and there was a heavy coral reef out there. And the tide had gone down, and there was only about maybe a foot and a half of water over the top of that coral. Well, that meant those landing craft barges couldn't cross it. Amtraks could with the tracks. But finally, Vandegrift, the Marine general, he gave the word, go in regardless of cost. Well, everybody took off, go in. We had five Sherman tanks and tank ladders. Well, they hit the reefs. Everybody hit the reefs. And the boats was stuck, and they couldn't. And that artillery from the beach and was just blasting us something awful. And I was driving an Amtrak. I had gone to a little briefing on North Island, New Zealand, where the Marines had Amtraks, because I had been a track layer in civilian life. They had a record of what my civilian work was. Anyway, I managed to get across that thing. It killed my motor a couple of times. And there was a Marine major named Crow, Major Crow, 2nd Marine Division. Him and his combat team was in my Amtrak. He told me, take me in about 75 or 100 yards and let us out and get out of here and go back and get another load of Marines. Just as we had to climb over a seawall, a little, wasn't too high, and there wasn't very many people on there had made it to the islands, and just a very few I could see through those little slots in the windshield. And just as I was getting ready to stop, boom, I hit something, or something hit me in the left front track, in the sprocket, and it dropped down and started to go around. And one track was dead, and so he yelled, okay, everybody out. So we had to jump over the side. Back in those days, because that was early in the war, there wasn't, we didn't have tailgates on those that you could let down a ramp, you know, let the people run out. You had to jump over the side, and so, or over the stern of this thing. So all of us, we piled out of there and run as fast as we could and jump back over that seawall. And then it was a destroyer come barreling in there, and he run aground on the coral. And he couldn't back out, but he was firing every gun he had on the island. Well, we stayed there until the tide started coming in. And then we had to move, because if you stick your head up over that seawall 6 inches, you was dead. They'd blow your head off, because the Japs was in the trenches right close by. I saw one man get his hand blown off from a Japanese hand grenade. The thing come bouncing on the ground and the smoke coming out of it, and he reached down and grabbed it and started to throw it back, and it blew up. And he had the poor guy, he had a terrible look on his face. Didn't have many medics in there because they couldn't get in. There was estimated 600 Marines and Navy that was killed before they ever got on the beach on Tarawa. We managed to go to that to the piers. There was some piers out there, and there was an old Japanese ship that was run aground and had been burned. And this destroyer started shelling those piers and shelling the, and we started walking. Otherwise, we'd had to go up over the top of that seawall, or we'd drown, you know. And the Haywood had their salvage boat. They had managed to get it over there, pretty close to that seawall. And I gave them a big signal, and they managed to ease in there, jump in, and get back out of there. Because the Japs had fire on them, you know. And the destroyer was firing on that pier and the land all around. Well, when you're moving, you know, you don't know what you're doing, really. You're kind of, you're doing things. You have to just, you run, try to do the right thing. But I got in that salvage boat, and that's how I ended up being a salvage boat the rest of the war. All except for Okinawa. They took me out of the boats, and they decided that I guess I had enough. I made a master of arms out of it.
Well, what about there at Tarawa? If that salvage boat wasn't there, what do you think would have happened to you?
Eventually, we would have, we might have got killed, because there's fire going on all over, you know, because those Japanese are very strong and determined. There was 5,000 Japanese Imperial Marines on that island. They figured that they was there, they was going to invade New Zealand. They'd had 15 years to build that island up, to fortify it like it was.
So you got back to your ship, the Haywood, and then did you have to take more trips in there later in the battle, or?
No, I didn't go back to the ship until the battle was over. I stayed in the salvage boat. Well, we lay there and help guide the boats through that coral, and because they would be boats bringing in Marines and bringing in supplies. Now, during the night, on that first night, there was a boat come along loaded with supplies from some other ship. They come up to the salvage boat. The boat commander that was in that salvage boat directed on how to get up to the pier. Couldn't guarantee any safety, but the way to go to get up there where there was somebody to take those supplies. I guess they had ammunition and whatever they had called for. So I told them, I'll volunteer. I'll go. Because they didn't have a boat engineer. I wasn't very much of an engineer anyway at that time. But anyway, I could help unload that boat. So we got up through there very slow, right along the slide of the pier. And then a guy stepped out. Hey, hold it right here. It was dark. And there was a long board that was on the pier. And we pulled up alongside, and he shoved that board out, and we put it on the gunnels on the boat and the pier, made something that could slide those case goods. They had all this different stuff. So I helped push those. One guy handed me the box, and I got out about halfway on that board and pulled it around me and slide it up to the another guy, a Marine, that was taking it. But we didn't get fired on. And then we went back, and I gave the officer that was in the salvage boat, I gave him back his 45, because I told him, I said, what happens if there's some Japs jump in the water with explosives and swim toward us? I don't have any weapon. So he took off his sidearm and gave it to me. So when I got back, I gave him back his 45, and I didn't have to shoot it. And there was a lot of things went on. You know, that unless you just try to get out of it. I never tried to get out of anything, but I never killed a Jap that I know of. I did fire. Now, the next day, the Marines come in with flamethrowers. And the only way they could get them out of the trenches and blockhouses, and they'd squirt that napalm up there, and they'd set it off. But those Japs would be firing on these guys. They killed a bunch of them, of those flamethrower operators. I did have an old, I don't know how I come to have that thing, was a Lewis 30 caliber machine gun, water cooled. And I did fire a few rounds to try to help those flamethrower guys to get a chance to try to keep those guys' heads down till they could give them a squirt of that napalm and burn them out of there. They'd come out running and burning their clothes on fire, and then the Marines kill them. I think there was only 3 prisoners of war out of 5,000 men, the Imperial Marines. And we lost a lot of people, too.
Yeah, over 1 square mile, famously called 1 square mile of hell, that battle, that island. And the visuals there were so striking that, you know, they made a documentary film about it. In fact, I've interviewed one of the guys who recorded a lot of that film that actually won an Oscar. And the Marine Corps has that wooden Oscar because metal was so scarce in their Marine Corps Museum in Quantico, Virginia. So if what those images captured on film, if they were powerful enough to motivate America to buy war bonds and feed this war machine, I'm guessing you saw some things that were pretty horrific and that you've probably seen in your memory a few times since.
Well, about the only thing you could, well, you could see one thing, you'd see those battleships at night firing those big 14, 16-inch guns. You'd see those three big balls of fire, red balls of fire coming. And they would hit those blockhouses, and some of them would explode, and some of them would ricochet off, and just see a big ball of fire going off into out of sight.
What about when that battle was over? Because it was a pretty quick battle. What did you see then?
Well, we got back to the ship, and black as the ace of spades from the gunpowder been settling down here, you know. So much firepower going on both sides. Well, got back to the ship and kind of settled down. And I never really let it bother me too much. Like I said before, I knew that I might get hit any time, or maybe ship would get sunk by a submarine or something, or maybe even hit a mine or something. Now, we had mine detector stuff on board there with paravanes that they'd put out to cut the mine loose from the cables that they'd come up, and we put our paravanes out sometimes, but we never did connect with a mine and bring it up. Well, now, one thing that I never got any, well, I wasn't a glory hound anyway, but I made smoke to cover the Honolulu, the light cruiser that was had been hit by a Jap torpedo airplane. So, and that was in, at Leyte Island in the Philippines. The beachmaster sent a message out to us, where we were just a little ways off of the beach with a salvage boat, and said that the ship said, send the salvage boat back to the ship immediately. Okay, we turn and take off and go back to the ship, and maybe about a mile and a half or so out. They already had floating smoke pots in the nets, and they told us to get over there to that cruiser that's burning, put smoke pots out for them, camouflage that ship. And, well, we headed for the ship as fast as we could, and we got over there. And they had a smoke generator, had a little gasoline engine and a blower. You could light it off. I guess it used bunker oil or something to, you know, you'd burn it. It would burn, and that fan and that thing would just blow smoke, all thick black smoke. And right away they told us, okay, go out so far out. They also gave us a radio operator and a little portable radio from the ship. So we got out there, and I made smoke for I don't know how long. It was a few hours, I guess. And that battle, sea battle, Leyte Gulf sea battle, was just getting started. And you could see the flashes of the big guns. We couldn't see the guns, or I mean the ships, but you could see in the big flashes of light. And that Japanese torpedo plane would come through our smoke. He's looking for that ship, but he couldn't find her because we had her covered up so good. And they could keep us in contact with if we was covering them or not, you know, and go here and tell us which way to change our course a little bit. And we was on the windward side of the ship, and the wind blew that smoke over them. I did see the Jap torpedo plane a couple times just for a few seconds as he'd come through a He was looking for that ship to put another torpedo into her. And finally, we got called in. The radio operator said, okay, the captain says, come back to the ship. So we come back over there, and the only thing we got out of that was, well done, man, from the captain. And that meant something.
And he's giving you a well done because you guys saved a lot of lives.
They may have been able to shoot that torpedo plane down, maybe, but there might have been more of them. I have often thought about if it hadn't have been that the sea battle was just starting, that Leyte Gulf sea battle that broke the back of the Japanese Navy, that did them in. But if that battle hadn't been going on, those Japs would have probably sent another airplane over there to put us out of commission, because we was prime targets. Here we going along there with the smoke coming right out of our boat and throwing out smoke pots, and they would have probably sent an airplane over there and knocked us out.
Just to make sure I understand and that people listening understand, your whole purpose in being there is to conceal this bigger cruiser, but you guys are pretty obvious because you have a plume of smoke coming out of your boat saying, here we are, if you want to shoot us, we're right here. Here's a big smoke signal for you.
I asked the radio operator, we had a little 30 caliber air-cooled machine gun on that boat, and this guy was coming across pretty not too far away, and I asked the operator to ask for permission if I could shoot that airplane down, and I got a negative on that. Said, fire only if you're fired on. So I guess he was probably afraid maybe I would shoot him down and he might glance right through the smoke and crash into the ship and the torpedo blow him up again anyway. So they didn't give me permission to shoot at him. But I never did really get a good long enough shot. I didn't see him long enough because that smoke was so thick. We'd get lost in our smoke, and they'd have to tell us what to change this or change that. And we had a gyro compass on that. You could set your heading and pretty well stay in where you was supposed to go. Yeah, we made it back to the ship, and they hoisted us aboard, and the sea battle was really going on by that time. It was getting dark. You could see those flashes of those big guns and the bombs, and there was a couple squadrons of PT boats cut across us when we was headed back for the Haywood.
So there you witnessed some of that Battle of Leyte Gulf. I know you would see kamikazes hit nearby ships during the Battle of Okinawa later on, and before that you were part of a feigned invasion, a decoy, or bait, we could even call you, trying to draw out enemy fire during the invasion of Tinian. 14 landings total in the Pacific during World War II. I know you also lost some people that you knew well among those 406,000 Americans who died in the war. And I know you're a regular listener to the show, so you probably see this question coming because I ask it a lot. All these years later, Mr. Hilton, what are you most proud of?
I guess that making smoke for that cruiser and kept her afloat, that would be one thing that saved the crew on that. There were three of us. There was a coxswain on this boat, and this was an LCPR. We did the best we could.
Kind of sounds like something you deserve a medal for.
Well, I never wanted any. I mean, I didn't feel that they owed me anything. I mean, I'm just happy to be able to do what we did and have the blessings that we got to be able to do what we did.
Forrest Hilton, 96 years old. Find photos and a short video with Mr. Hilton online at hometownheroesradio.com, where the podcast version of this episode has a few additional stories that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.